At this time, I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. Please join me now in extending a warm welcome to Danny.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Steve, thank you for asking me to speak. I am an alcoholic, and my name is Danny Shirley.
Amen.
My home group is the Mount Trashmore Speaker Meeting. Meets on Thursday nights at 7:30. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and they're both here tonight to make sure I tell the truth. Yeah, the first time I ever spoke, it was kind of impromptu, and I asked Steve, I said, so what do I do? He said, you tell the truth. I said, but I've never done that before. Because I had. I lied and kind all my life. My sobriety date is September the 3rd, 1995. I took my first drink in 1959. Started drinking alcoholically in 1965. Attended my first AA meeting in 1975, and as I just stated, my sobriety date September 3rd, 1995. So for a long time, I made countless vain attempts to control my drinking, and it never got better, it only got worse. Now, there were a few times that I was able to stop for certain periods of time, only because I thought that what I was trying to achieve, like get my license back or maybe some other minor thing, like please my wife's parents. But as soon as I accomplished whatever that goal was, I was off and running and drinking again. So, you know, that drink I mentioned that I took when I was 6 years old, me and my brother were walking from our school about a half mile to the house, and there was a full can of Pabst Blue Ribbon laying in the road. Of course, back then they made beer out of steel cans, and I kicked that thing all the way home. We got onto my street, and they were repaving the road, so it had some aggregate sticking up, and as soon as I kicked on there, it sprung a hole in it. I picked it up and started drinking some of it. And my brother was going, ooh, that's gross. And I said, nah, man, it tastes like apple juice. I can tell you that I never cared for the taste of alcohol. And that was probably the only time in my life that I thought I liked the taste of it. As it says in the doctor's opinion, men and women essentially drink for the effects produced by alcohol. And of course, the first couple of times I read that in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought that meant because it got you all buzzed up and everything, but no, that's not what that means. It talks about, you know, making us feel normal and that we fit in and all that stuff. And then it goes on to talk about, you know, continuing to drink, and even though we realize the harm that it's doing to us, it doesn't seem to matter. I'm having fun. For a while, anyway. Started drinking alcoholically when I was 12. We would either steal beer or get somebody to buy it for us, and or liquor, whatever, and then go back in the woods and drink it, and hopefully escaped the parents when we got home. Of course, back then it was a little different than the world is today. Most people were afraid to keep their kids on the street after it gets dark. And back when I was a little young, that age, I used to come home 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. Nobody even thought about it. Attended my first AA meeting in 1975 at the wishing of my father. At that time, I think I had accumulated maybe 6 or 7 DUIs. Not that that makes me an alcoholic. I have a total of 9 DUIs on my record. Well, 8 of them. One of them didn't show up because actually it paid the judge off on that one. $200, I was off the hook. That's what happens when you got a good lawyer. But the thing about it is, trouble is not trouble when you get out of it. But my father knew this woman that was in Alcoholics Anonymous, who happened to be a customer at his store, and I worked with my dad from the time I was six until after he died. And he asked her if she could help me, because there was actually a guy that was a friend of his who worked at a furniture store who he knew was a drunk, but then he noticed he was dressing up all kind of sharp and he was clean and didn't smell like alcohol anymore, and he thought maybe he might be able to help me. And he said, nah, he said, I'm just struggling to get this thing going myself, but you might ask Ann. And so the woman came in the store and she said, well, I can help him if he wants any help. And so to please my father, I agreed that I wanted some help, which was the very last thing I actually wanted. And she said, well, I can help him then. So she would come and pick me up, take me to meetings. I never once stopped drinking. As soon as I'd get home from the meetings, I'd jump in my car or someone else's car and go get me some alcohol, or either I'd already have it waiting there for me, and I would drink. A couple of years went by, never quit drinking. She was taking me all of these meetings, and I'm pulling my kind game. I'll get into a little bit more of that in a minute. Just want to capture the dates I gave you. And my father passed away. He had his own business. He also worked in the Portsmouth shipyard. So after he got off work in the Portsmouth shipyard, his store closed at 6. He'd get there at 5 o'clock, work till 9 o'clock, you know, doing paperwork after the store closed. And Ann came to pick me up. And Ann is Ann Knuckles. I don't know if any of y'all know her, but I know a couple of people do. But she died in 56 years of sobriety. And actually, she was my first sponsor, even though I didn't realize it at that time. That woman went to any length to try to help me get sober, but I just was not compliant. Of course, it wasn't my goal. The goal was to make my dad happy. So after my dad died, she came in the store to pick me up one day, and she said, come on, let's go to the meeting. I said, Ann, you know, my dad just died. She said, I know that. She said, more reason for you to go. I said, well, you know, he used to stay here and work late. And I said, I'm sure, absolutely sure, that he would want me to do the same thing. So I can't go to a meeting with you tonight. You know, I'm off the hook. Dad's dead. I don't have to go anymore. And she just looked at me with the what I thought was a strange look at the time, because she very politely pointed her finger at me and she said, let me just tell you one thing. I said, what's that, Ann? She said, I have planted a seed, and I hope and pray that one day you will allow God to let that grow. And she turned and walked out the store. Now I'm thinking, this woman's crazy. She's planted a seed? Nah, that just sounds weird to me, man. I don't know where she's coming with that, but I ain't got no seeds in me. Anyway. And then eventually I got sober on September 3rd, got here and I didn't get sober then. We'll talk about that. That was my sobriety date. I used another date earlier. We'll get to that. So when I was young, we all hung out in the woods, smoked cigarettes, drank beer, drank liquor, did whatever other crazy stuff we did. We went to football games and would find somebody with the car unlocked and hot wire, take it out for a ride, and sometimes when we got back before the game was over, we could find the same parking space, and sometimes we couldn't, so we would just park it wherever we could find a space. And I'm just would always wonder, what were them people thinking? I know I parked my car over here, now it's all the way over there. But and of course we're smoking in their cars and drinking, and so you know they probably realized someone had stolen their car. And but we, that's the things that we did. Now, some of my story includes other topics, so I'll just let you know right now. I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am nothing but an alcoholic. The way I see it is, if I had been a bank robber and alcoholic, I wouldn't have been a bank robber and alcoholic. I would have just been an alcoholic that robbed banks. Anything else I have ever done in my life that was unacceptable to society or just pure insane was because of a result of my alcoholism and nothing else. When I got to be, I think I was 15 when I got arrested on some felony drug charges. And at this time, I'm full-blown alcoholic too. And let me back up for a second. Around the age of 14, drugs came into my life. And I thought I had found something to get outside of reality that didn't taste bad. Like I told you in the beginning, alcohol to me tasted terrible, but I liked the effects. So I dabbled around with that a little bit, but I was over at somebody's house one day and we were all doing whatever, and this guy walked in the front door with a six-pack of Miller High Life. Back then it was in clear bottles. I have no idea what it's in now. But the sunlight hit that six-pack of beer just right. And all along I knew I had been missing something since I had stopped drinking, that the drugs or whatever else just were not fulfilling. And he came in and I said, "Can I get one of those?" He said, "Sure." Well, I drank four of those six beers. And it was at that point that I realized what I was missing out on, or what I was not getting fulfilled with anything else I was trying to do. It's alcohol. So from that day forward until September 3rd, 1995, I drank as much as I could. Anyway, forward to getting arrested. I had never been in trouble before. People at that time were getting 40 years for what I was charged with. I had a good lawyer. As a matter of fact, his dad was the head judge in Portsmouth at the time. And so I could pretty much get anything done as long as my dad paid the money. And so they made a deal that they would drop all but one charge. If I would plead guilty to that, they'd give me 2 years in prison and no fine. Everybody else getting 40 years and a big fine. So I went into jail. They had to get a judge from out of town to try me because my dad was friends with all the judges and my lawyer's dad was the head judge. And so while I was in jail, I finished my junior year in high school. My dad had private tutors come in, and which was unheard of. And just so happened that one of the tutors was involved in some illegal activity himself, and me and him became real good friends. And I got out in 6 months. We petitioned the court based on my good behavior, finishing junior year in high school in jail. The judge decided to let me out. I was going to another school in Portsmouth at the time in Churchland. But the judge, on one condition, he said, "You'll have to change high schools, and because you know too many people at Churchland, I want you to go to Wilson." Well, hell, I knew just as many people at both of them. Didn't make much sense to me, but I complied. In the next 4 years, I believe, Bill talks about it in the big book about sedatives and gin. Now, I wasn't too heavy on the gin, but any other kind of alcohol, I'd drink it. Except wine, I didn't care for wine either. But during that time, I was found comatose from barbiturate alcohol poisoning. Had not someone found me, I would have died. And I was found twice by police officers and once by an ambulance driver. And immediately after I was found by them and got out of the hospital, when I saw them, I told them to never touch me again. Don't you dare touch me again, especially one of them, because he'd had my brother put in jail. I told him if he touched me again, I'd kill him. Today I realized, or many years ago, I realized that they were God's angels doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because had they not found me, I'd be dead. I wouldn't be standing here talking to you now. I believe that God has played a big role in all that, because I have certainly faced death in a lot of situations. There's no telling how many other times I was laying out there comatose. Somebody just didn't find me, and by some miracle, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, I continued to live. But each one of them times, and what I'm about to tell you is not from my personal knowledge, it's what my father shared with me later. The first time I was taken to the hospital, when they found me comatose, they finally got all the, you know, got me stabilized, and then they put me in Portsmouth Psychiatric Center, and that's where I came to. And my mom and dad were sitting there by my bedside, and because the doctors had told them that I may come out of it, and I may not, I may have mental damage, or just might not live. And when I came to the first time, my mother was so overcome with, I certainly wouldn't call it joy, just overcome with the fact that I was alive and my eyes were open and I was breathing on my own, that she was overtaken and left the room. And my dad told me that, you know, you're killing your mother. He said, you're killing both of us, but you're really killing your mother. And they kept me in there another week, and then I got out, and it was just back to the same old thing. It's like, it's no big deal. I don't know what you're making a big deal out of all this. You know, my dad, he was always, I thought, interfering in my life. But I realized that he just loved me. I don't ever really remember him cursing at me or yelling at me. He just told me like it was. He said, son, we just love you and we want to see the best for you, and we believe you're headed down the wrong track. These friends you have, they don't care about you. If they would have found you, they would have let you die. And, you know, I just said, Dad, you don't know what you're talking about. And he would just let it go. Like I said, he wouldn't argue with me. He said, we just love you. Anyway, the second time I woke up in the hospital, comatose, coming out of a coma. My mother was not there. My father was there. And I had the gall to ask my father, where's my mom at? Why isn't she here? And he's just crying. He said, you're killing us. He said, she couldn't stand to see you like this. And I said, I don't know what y'all are talking about. I don't know why y'all are making a big deal out of this. Well, the third time this happened, came to, there was nobody sitting there. And so when the head nurse come by, I called her over and I said, where's my parents? She said, they didn't come this time. She said, but the doctors at Maryview Hospital said that they had given up on you. I said, given up on me? What kind of parents do that to their child? And I forgot what she said, but it was probably something along the lines of, you better get your act together, or you're going to be dead here one day. I don't really know what she said, but... So, you know, I had basically... I was destroying my parents' life. How could you be happy, joyous, and free, or even happy at all, or even enjoy life watching one of your kids do this to themselves? But I thought it was no big deal. I thought they were the weird ones. I thought they were making a big deal out of nothing. I'm fine. Just let me do what I want to do. I'm fine. You know, back, just a couple years back, when I got out of jail for that time, I went to jail. Mom came and picked me up, and my friends were writing me letters, and I told them when I was getting out. And so no sooner than my mom pulled in the driveway at our house, my dad's at work. No sooner she pulled in the driveway, my friends pulled up. I got out of my mom's car, walked over and got in their car. My mom's sitting here, "Where are you going?" And, you know, just told him, "Guy, just go, go. Don't pay attention to her." Well, she called my dad, as she normally had to do. And if he had to come home from work at shipyard, he was obviously going to be mad. Anyway, he tracked me down somehow. We were at the end of this dead-end road, smoking and drinking. And when he turned the corner in his day-glow orange van, I'd like to call it, it was the brightest thing and the longest thing on the planet. And most of the guys I was in the car with 3 years older than me, one of them was 4 years older, the driver. And they all said, "Here comes your dad." And so I said, "Let's get out of here." And said, "And there ain't nowhere to go. It's a one-lane dead-end road." I said, "Drive around him." No, he kind of got there. And then he made sure he pulled his van like this. And my dad, he carried a gun because he used to make night deposits at his store. And he only bought it for that reason. And but that day, I believe he feared for his life because there was five crazy people in the car and just him. So he had the gun in his hand when he got out of the van. And he said, "Danny, you're coming with me." And I said, "I ain't going with him." And the guy driving the car, he said, "Get the fuck out of my car." I'm sorry. He said, "Get out of my car, man." So I got out, got in the van. My dad, again, not yelling, not cursing, pleading, telling me he loved me. And I said, "Just leave me alone, man. You don't know what you're talking about. I'm fine." I said, "Just take me home." So he took me home. He went back to work. Next time I saw that guy driving the car, he told me, he said, "You know, Danny, your dad's crazy." He said, "If he ever pulls out a gun on me again, I'm going to kill him." I'm ashamed to say it today, but what I told him at that time was, "Do what you got to do." You know, I understand that the reason I said those things about parents that I loved was because I didn't know that I didn't know. I was delusional. I had no idea what was going on in my life. I had no idea how insane I was. You know, when I first got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the second step talks about restoring us to sanity. I said, "I'm not insane. Y'all are insane." I continued to drink right up until, you know, and my mom and my dad never got to see me sober. But I know today they're tickled to death, or I would hope so. My dad died suddenly from an aneurysm right next to his heart, so I really didn't get the chance to say goodbye to him. But I had gone out to the car to go to lunch, to go drink some alcohol and do whatever else. And the girl come running out and said, "Dad, oh, Danny, your father has fallen on the floor. We don't know what's wrong." And I went back in, and he was pretty much dead at the time. He died 5 hours later in the hospital. You know, my mom died a painful death. It took her a couple of months to die. She had cancer. But I almost missed seeing her living in her last moment because I stopped at the 7-Eleven to get some alcohol on the way after my brother had called me. I better come quickly or I may not see her alive again. But I had to stop at the 7-Eleven and get some alcohol. I needed some gas too, but I didn't take time to get the gas. I got the alcohol left. When I turned the last exit there on 17 at the nursing home out there, the car sputtered for a moment because, you know, all the gas one side of the tank and you ain't got much gas. When I got in there, I ran like O.J. Simpson through the airport. got to her room, grabbed her hand. She looked up at me, closed her eyes, and died. But, you know, I never got to make amends to them for any, all the harm that I had done them. So, you know, that bothered me for a long time. But through the power of God and my understanding in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to get through that. I got married in 1981 to an alcoholic of my type. Before we got married, we got in an argument. She sucker punched me. She was a feisty woman. I saw stars. I slapped her. And then she's chasing me around the house with a butcher knife. Ominous warning that should have been. But we continue to drink and be married for several years. The best way I can describe our relationship and our marriage was tumultuous. A word that's synonymous with that is violent. I never hit her again, and I'm not proud of hitting her that time, but it was kind of a natural reaction to being sucker punched and seeing stars. But, you know, but we had a beautiful daughter out of that marriage. And I tried to get her help. Of course, Ann Knuckles told me, "Danny, you are the last person on this planet that can help that woman." You know, because, and I had kind of put myself up on a pedestal. And, but she eventually succumbed to the disease of alcoholism and died at the age of 42. We did make somewhat of an amends before she died, before she ended up in the hospital on deathbed. Because, you know, at this time I don't know if you would call it sober, but I hadn't drank in 2 years. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had, you know, her and her mother-in-law, I hated them. As a matter of fact, my first sponsor said, "What you need to do is pray for them." I said, "I'd sooner kill them as look at them. You want me to pray for them?" But the day that I did pray for them, it was like they knew. Everything just changed. But what I realized is that was, you know, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I realized that I had forgiven them for everything that I ever thought they had done to me. Because later on in my inventories, I found out that I was the one that set the ball in motion. They were just defending themselves. However poorly it may have been, they were just defending themselves. I was it wrong. So anyway, she died, and my daughter was already living with my in-laws because I felt that was the only way I could protect her from my alcoholic wife. Because every day I used to go to work knowing I was going to come home and find a house in ashes with both of them dead inside, because I'd come home and find her passed out on the couch with cigarettes falling on the floor and burning the carpet and whatever. But anyway, you know, I had made somewhat amends to her, you know, because I had found that, you know, that I went from hating these people with the intent to kill to unconditional love. And the only thing that made that possible was Alcoholics Anonymous and a God of my understanding. After my wife had died, a member of my family had died, and I was at his grave, and I didn't realize it, but her mother came over to me and tapped me on the back of the shoulder, scared the hell out of me. But she was out there at my ex-wife's grave, her daughter's grave. And she always thought that, you know, everything was my fault, but she came to the realization that it was our fault. And we made amends right there in the graveyard. But so I had told you previously that I was able to stop drinking at certain points to get something back. My driver's license had been taken indefinitely for being a habitual offender. But I petitioned the court, and I was pulling a con game because I went to a doctor whose wife at the time was the mayor of the city of Portsmouth. And I didn't drink anything for a year, because when I called the lawyer that was going to represent me, I talked to him for like 15 minutes on the phone. And he wrote me a letter afterwards. He said, well, you got to wait a year before you can petition the court. But a few days later, I got a letter in the mail. He said, seeing that you are an alcoholic, I said, man, I've talked to this guy 15 minutes on the phone, and he's already classified me as an alcoholic. What's up with this? Well, you know, I pretty much told him my life story on the phone, and he figured it out. But so I petitioned the court. I had all these character witnesses there. I had this doctor's testimony that I had been passing all these tests, that there was no alcohol in my body. He didn't seem that I was a threat to society. And now his wife is the mayor of the city of Portsmouth, so he's got a little pull in the judge's eyes. And I get all these character witnesses to show up, and the prosecuting and my lawyer go up there to the desk, and then they turn around, and my lawyer's going like, come on, let's go. I'm like, what do you mean, let's go? All these characters. He said, let's go. And I said, let's go. So we walk out, and I said, well, what's up with this? I said, I brought all these character witnesses. I didn't testify. And he said, no need. He said, the doctor looked at the records, the judge looked at the doctor's records. And he heard what I told him. And he said, if Danny Shirley can do this, he can have his license back. Because that's how well the judges knew me down there. I was stone cold alcoholic. But if I could do all this, pass all these tests, go 2 years without drinking, I'm good. Well, we went on a vacation right after our daughter was born. I hadn't drank in 2 years. And I was afraid to drink. I figured if I drank and got caught, I'm going to prison. And we get up there, and my wife's still doing all this stuff. She's got her wine coolers and her straw and, you know, all this stuff. And so I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. And I don't know why. But I had felt that way for a long time. But I didn't know why. When it talks about it in the doctor's opinion, that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent because I have taken away the only thing that gave me relief, the alcohol. I didn't have a God of my understanding. It was just me and the world. I thought people were supposed to be happy. They were still upset with me. Anyway, we're on vacation, and we headed back to the campground. And my wife says, and I'm pulling into a general store. She said, what are you pulling in here for? You don't smoke. You don't drink. We got gas. I got wine coolers. There's nothing we need here. And I said, I think I'm going to buy me a beer. She said, but you don't drink. I said, I'm just going to get one 24-ounce Budweiser. That's it. Because I'm thinking that's going to make everything okay. Next thing I remember was coming to, standing in front of a fire pit in the campground. Everybody's tents are destroyed. What had happened, a storm had come through, and windy storm and torrential rains and wiped everything out. But I'm standing in front of a fireplace, but now I'm drinking a Michelob in a bottle. I'm wondering where that came from. And then I look at my wife and I said, what happened? She said, don't even go there. Because I looked at my tent and it was in worse shape than everybody else's. I said, what happened? She said, don't even go there. And I said, what do you mean? She said, you know, she just started going off, and I looked in the fire pit and I said, where did all of them come from? She said, please. Well, I had driven to the store, bought a case of beer, didn't even know it, and drank it all and tore my tent down. And so I remember at that moment the feeling that came over me. because I thought I was over drinking. But the feeling was what it refers in the big book of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I just felt horrible. Worst, I never felt that bad before. I just didn't understand. But at that moment, right after that, I said, screw it. May as well keep on drinking. So I did for a couple of years. My wife came up to a bar one night where I was at, and she ordered her first drink. The bartender cut her off because she was drunk. She blamed that on me. She thought I had told him not to serve her anything. So she stormed out of there. She was ripped. So instead of letting her get in her car and drive and possibly kill someone, I ran out there and was trying to get the keys away from her. We had a struggle. She's beating on me. I'm pushing her, and these kids ride by on a bike. They go to a payphone, call police. Domestic dispute in the parking lot. Cops come, eight of them. And she's sitting behind the wheel. Car wasn't running, so they didn't charge her for DUI. But what they decided is, well, we can't let these two go home. They'll kill each other. So we probably just ought to take them to jail, let them sleep it off. And so they said, well, you know, before you get in the car, we got to search her. Well, the guy inside had just given me a couple of joints. First thing the guy does it. Quick guy here, guys. Well, I'd been arrested for that kind of stuff before, so this charge was going to be a felony. And so first idea comes to my head, you go see a psychiatrist. She'll put you on some pills, she'll testify in court, you get out of it. So I go see this doctor, not the one I wanted to see, but just the one that I could only fit in before my court date. She said, tell me why you're here. I told her my story, and she said, well, she said, your time's up. I'll see you at the next meeting. And she said, no, there won't be any next meeting. I said, what do you mean? You got to, you know, I need your help. She said, I can't help you. I said, what do you mean you can't help me? She said, well, from what you tell me, you're an alcoholic. And I said, no, I'm not. She said, yeah, you're an alcoholic. She said, and only a spiritual awakening is going to help you. I said, a spiritual awakening? What is that? She said, well, I would suggest you start, and I knew exactly what she was going to say, Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, no, no, no. I said, it's got to be something else. She said, well, there is intensive outpatient care. I said, sign me up. She said, well, you got to go to Portland. So I went over there, signed up, talked to the judge. He said, we can help you. Talked to the doctor, and he said, we can help you. I said, see, I knew that woman could help me. He said, but we have a few conditions. I said, what's that? He said, you got to get a home group, you got to get a sponsor, and some other stuff. He said, this is all on honor system. Well, after 2 weeks, they asked me where my home group was. I didn't have one. He said, don't come back no more until you have a home group. So I was forced into going to Craddock that night. And so my mom had just died, so I used July the 19th as my sobriety date. As I've told you here tonight, it's September 3rd, 1995. So I didn't quit drinking for 45 days. I came to meetings and was pulling the kind game because I didn't come here to get sober. I came here to get something good on my resume so when I went to court, the judge would let me go, which he did eventually let me go after about a year, and the charge was dismissed, but that had nothing to do with me. That had other than finally getting sober, but that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself again. So anyway, they kicked me out of there, and then finally I come back. But anyway, it was time to celebrate my anniversary on July the 3rd, or July the 19th. This is like 3 years out, or 2 years out. And I told my sponsor, I said, Dale, I got something to talk to you about. He said, what's that? And I kept hesitating. He said, well, the meeting getting ready to start. We got to go in. And I said, well, July the 19th is not my sobriety date. He said, I know. I said, hey, what do you mean, how do you know? He said, I know. He said, but you ain't hurting nobody but yourself, Dan. He said, but if it's not your anniversary date, then you probably ought to go tell the secretary so we don't throw our money away on a cake for you next week. He said, do you know when it is? And I said, well, I can figure it out because it was so many days before I had to go to court. I went home that night and asked God to help me not just drink for the day, and I haven't had a drink since then. That was September 3rd, 1995. So I got here 45 days later. I finally stopped drinking. Standing outside one night, my sponsor had mentioned it before, but he said, "Dan, I thought you and I went in that chapel over there and did the third step prayer together." I said, "We did." He said, "Why you keep taking it back?" I said, "What do you mean taking it back?" He said, "You haven't turned your will and your life over to the care of God. You still want to be in charge of it." "I know I don't." "Yeah, you do." He said, "You know, I'm just telling you for your own good, you know, you need to turn your will and your life over." So I actually had to go back and start over, because step one, there's two parts of that. Admitted that I was without defense against the first drink, and that my life is unmanageable. Well, I didn't believe my life was unmanageable. I thought you, all of y'all, were unmanageable. That's what was causing all the chaos in my life, was y'all. And then, as earlier I mentioned, sure, there's a God out there that can restore me to sanity, but the thing is, I am not insane. You are. And then if I'm really going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I got to let it go and let Him do something. I'm still hanging on to it. So I had to do all that over again. Then it came to the inventory. Oh my God. 2 or 3 years later, a sponsor finally said, "Saturday night, be here. We're doing your inventory." Now I'm writing my inventory out on a computer. Drew me some nice columns and listing and everything. But I only had what the resentment was and what they did to me to cause the resentment. And so when I get there to do it, I break it out and show it to him. He said, "What is this?" "This is my inventory." He said, "Well, you don't have what it affected in you, and you don't have your part in it." I said, "My part in it?" I said, "I need to add you to this list now. Do you think I had something to do with this? It was all them." And then he said, "I think we need to start back over at page one." And I really got mad then. But then eventually he had to move out of town, or moved out of town. And he said, "You need to find you a new sponsor." And I said, "For what?" And I said, "You know, got free long distance on these things." He said, "You need somebody that can watch your feet." "Watch my feet? What's he talking about?" "I need somebody that can make sure I'm doing what I'm telling you I'm doing." So anyway, I got a sponsor. Then he had to move to Oregon. It's all his fault. And so I sponsored myself for a couple years. And let me tell you something. That is worse than drinking and all the trouble I ever got into could be. That's worse than all that. So I don't recommend that to anybody. I was ready to kill you or me. Somebody was going to die. And so I kept praying to God. Now, I've prayed all my life, but most of the time before it was, "God, let's make a deal." Now it's, "God, what is the deal?" But I was asking God to point me in the direction of my sponsor, my new sponsor. And I had some thoughts, but as soon as they entered my head, I kicked them out. "Nah, not that guy." And then there was really this one guy that I just thought he was Mr. AA. And I said, "Nah, ain't no way." I was standing on the steps of Craddock one night, and he comes walking in, and I said, "Hey, can I talk to you a minute?" And he said, "Well, can we talk after the meeting?" I said, "Sure." And as soon as he went inside, I said, "Why in the hell did I ask him to talk to me?" So then after the meeting, he says, "So what do you want to talk about, Dan?" I said, "Well, I was wondering if you would be my sponsor." He said, "Well, that's what I thought you wanted." And still I'm asking myself, why am I doing this? Well, I can tell you, it was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because that man, Alcoholics Anonymous and a God Understanding, saved my life starting with that night. I became willing to do whatever he told me to do or asked me to do. Well, so then we got to the inventory. And I had written it all out. I said, well, I'm going to do it this time. And we get there to do the fifth step. And we go through the fifth step. He's sharing with me, you know, stuff that happened in his life, things he did that were similar to mine or not even similar. And so at the end of it all, he said, so are you done? I said, yeah, I'm done. He said, are you sure? I'm thinking to myself, why is he asking me this? Because, see, I knew there was one thing that I wasn't going to share with anybody because it wasn't under the daggone business. And it said in the big book, or at least I thought it said, that God and I could handle this together. Anyway, it says. So, I think he asked me one more time, you sure? And I said, but then, that's right. But then he started sharing something that was similar to what I was holding on to. And right then, I don't know if I heard God speaking to me, but this is what was going through my mind was, now is your opportunity, Danny, to be a free man. Do you want to be a free man? And my answer was yes. So I said, well, there is one more thing. He said, I thought there was. So I told him about it, and then we went through all that. And at the end, he put his arm around me and he said, Danny, you are now a free man. He said, now go home and, you know, do 6 and 7 and we'll get back together. So I went home. I'm on a roll. I did exactly what it says in the book. We take this book down from the shelf. The book was laying on the table. I put it up on the shelf. I said, I ain't messing this up. This is going too good right now. So I took the book down, read it. We got back together. Now, there were some things, you know, in the 8th step, you've already made your list by doing your 4th step and your 5th step. But then you have to, there are things in my discussion with my sponsor that we add to that list in which there's no harm in connection with. And so we did that. And then it was, you know, one thing real quick, and I know I'm running out of time, but after we did the inventory and the fifth step and everything, my sponsor told me that it was now time that I go out and start sponsoring some people. Because up to that point, I hadn't sponsored anybody anyway, and it's probably a good thing I did. God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Stay away from that guy. But anybody I have ever sponsored, you know, I come from a tough home group. Craddock was known to be tough. And not a lot of times, I didn't see it, but I did see it. And it still happens in all the groups too, that I'm your sponsor. You know, I never did that to anybody, you know, tell them I'm going to be your sponsor. Anybody that I have ever sponsored asked me to be their sponsor. And what I have found about all of them people, I believe this is God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because everybody I have ever sponsored has had a message for me. Something that I was not taking a close look at, that they shared about in their life that made me look at my own self. So I believe that was God's way of working through people to get to me. But, you know, the first couple of amends that I made in my 9th step were amends that I needed to make for things that I did in sobriety. And the first person I went to, the last thing she ever said to me when I was leaving her place of business was, don't ever come here again or I will call the police. So I went there. I was a little afraid to go in at first, but I said, well, you know. And it talks about that in the big book, about being thrown out. But, of course, I was thinking I might even be arrested. But I went in, and she saw me standing there, and she said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I wanted to speak to you. And she unbelievably said, well, come on back here in my office. She's taking me back there in the back when before she was threatening to arrest me. And it's just me and her. I couldn't believe it. And I told her why I was there. I said what I needed to say and did what I needed to do. And I asked her what it was, anything I could do to, you know, make it right with her. And she said, just keep doing what you're doing. So I walked out the store and sat in my truck and cried for about 30 minutes. Just not cry from sorrow, but crying from the weight that was lifted off. And the joy and the happiness and the freedom that I was experiencing through the program, Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor and the guide of my understanding. So I was on a roll. I went down to an old store right down the street where I had created a scene. Called the girl outside. She came out there and talked to me. And I asked her what I could do to make it right. And she said, you've already done it. She said, by you telling me what you have told me, I know now that I need to go do the same thing with someone else. You know, step 10, I continue to take personal inventory. When I'm wrong, try to promptly admit it. At night when I retire, I always answer yes to something. Whether I've been resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid, I find sometimes that afraid is always an answer or a check mark. But you know, back in the fourth step, it talks about fear. Why did we have these fear? Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And then it talks about God reliance, and when we rely on God, there is no fear. And I've experienced that so many times in my life. And I've experienced so many times that when I rely on God, regardless of the circumstances, they don't change. But everything else changes. It's no longer chaos, it's serenity. Just by changing the reliance. Step 11, I was sitting in a meeting one night, you know, just I was stuck and I couldn't figure it out. And somebody talked about listening. And that was my part. I wasn't listening to what God had to say, or I wasn't listening to what you were telling me that God intended for me to hear. And step 12, continue to, you know, carry the message and help all the alcoholics. You know, and having a spiritual awakening, becoming God conscious. I talk to God all day long. If I didn't, I'd be a complete basket case. But when I talk to God, everything's happy, joyous, and free. Now, don't get me wrong. I still get restless, irritable, and discontent, but I can identify it right away, and I know what's wrong. I've taken charge again. I just have to let go and let God. Sorry to keep you all over. I've got a lot more I could share with you, but my time's out. Thank you very much.
Danny, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Heard a lot of parallels to my own story and some of the things that I've done, you've done, and how you were sponsored, I was sponsored, and how I sponsor guys. And it always goes better when I bring God into the situation. You know, went through it today a little bit, you know, and I had to pray about it.